let's go ahead and get started. How's everybody doing? Good? How's the conference going so far? Getting good stuff out of it? All right, great. Well, we're here for the next 75 minutes to talk about building your own REST service with Web API 2. This is kind of a follow-on to what Bob German just finished when he was talking about MVC 5 up here, and now we're moving into how to use that to create our own REST services. Before we jump into that, if I haven't had the pleasure of meeting you, this is my little intro slide here. I've probably seen a few of you in some of the sessions I've done already, so we'll keep it short. Basically, I've been in the SharePoint business since 2003. I really don't do anything else every day except write code in SharePoint, and it's been that way for the last decade. I'm the author of several books. You see them up here, and you see over there on the right the brands that you'll find my name under. In keeping with my sort of mini theme that I've presented at each one of my sessions, we're going to finish up here on this idea of moving from bricks to houses. And what I mean by that when I say moving from bricks to houses is that our relationship with SharePoint has really changed as developers. When we're in the 2010 world, we had a very intimate relationship with SharePoint. The types of solutions that we created were really plugged directly into the DNA of SharePoint. We dealt with things at a very low level. And to me, that always felt like extending the product. You know, you became one with the product and extended it. And so we built bricks. But in 2013, of course, all that's changed, and now we're responsible for so much more of the infrastructure and plumbing than we ever were before. In fact, if you go all the way up to building a house that's a provider-hosted app, you have to drop your own infrastructure potentially, right, and manage all the plumbing back to SharePoint. So what it means for us is that we really have a significant amount of new knowledge that we have to absorb, and we've been busy doing that this week, looking at things like HTML5, Angular, Knockout, those types of things. And we're going to wrap that today in this session by talking about building RESTful services, and we're going to take care of it in three big chunks here. We're going to talk about how to build a RESTful service and then how to go on and make that an OData service, and the importance of OData, which I've been emphasizing all week, is really, you know, that's the currency of the realm. That's how we talk to SharePoint data. That's how we're going to talk to our custom databases as well. And for the most part, during the session, I'm going to do things anonymously until the end when we're going to talk about how to secure the Web API services. So try to keep it simple in the beginning and then add in some security concerns as we go along. Okay, so with that as the groundwork, let's go ahead and get started and start talking about building RESTful services. Now, when we talk about building RESTful services, you know, REST is something people say all the time in the SharePoint community. You hear, oh, SharePoint is REST, you know, let's talk about REST, that kind of stuff. But do you really know what a RESTful service is? I mean, what makes a service RESTful? If I ask people what makes a service RESTful, they often say to me, well, I'm accessing it with some kind of specialized URI. And that's true, it's part of it. But here, perhaps for the first time, you'll see that these are the actual real REST constraints as defined by Fielding in his PhD dissertation when he invented this architecture. So some of this stuff is simple and easy to understand why it's in place, and others perhaps will get you thinking about gaps in what you've created and maybe how to fill them. So from the top, in order to truly be a RESTful service, you have to be client-server, which means that the client is going to pull representations from the server. Now, that word representations is important to us because the data that we get has to be represented in some format, right? We have to agree on something that we're going to exchange between the server and client that we both understand. Also, client-server provides a separation of concerns. So when I design my RESTful services, you don't necessarily care what clients are calling it, not from a security point of view, but just by separation of concerns. I want to be able to provide a functional endpoint, and as long as you speak HTTP to me, that's fine, we can talk. The second constraint is that they're stateless. That is that the client is going to provide all necessary context back to the server. Something's going to happen through a get or a post or a put, and then the server's going to forget that you were ever there. It's not going to remember anything about some transaction you're engaged in. You are expected to come back with all of the necessary state and context to continue the process, and then the server responds to that operation and that operation only. A key thing about REST constraints that you don't hear a lot about is that caching is a REST constraint. And that means that the data that comes, the entities, representations that come from the server, have to indicate whether or not they can be cached. So we expect as a client to receive that entity, and it's going to tell us it's okay for you to remember this for a while, and it's going to indicate to that us to that condition to us by using things like e-tags, which allows us to engage in optimistic concurrency. It's going to be able to say things like when this entity expires. So if you're holding on to it too long, maybe you should go refresh it and then do something else with it. The fourth constraint is interface, and this is the one that most people mention when they talk about REST, and that is that resources are accessible through URIs, uniform resource indicators. We're all familiar with URLs, right? We type URLs into the browsers all the time. A URL is a form of URI. The thing about the RESTful services that we create is that the URIs are not going to end up pointing to pages, right? They're going to end up pointing to entities that we want to perform operations on. So we expect endpoints to be things like employees, contacts, products, that type of thing. The resource operations are all through HTTP verbs, right? So our entire communication from client to server is going to be gets and puts and posts and deletes, okay? That's easy. The same representations can be used for all the operations, and basically what that means is we're going to agree on what it means to look like a client, the form of a product, and that representation is going to apply for all the operations that we perform, all the various CRUD operations or others. And resources are interconnected to allow linking, which means that when you get back information from one of these represented entities, it will contain in it links to other representations. So for example, if you have a category, it may include links to products, or a product may include backlink to the category it belongs to, that type of thing. So there's an interconnectedness that is reflected in the relationships of the entities in what you get back. And the final REST constraint is that it has to be layered, which simply means that it doesn't matter where you are, behind a gateway, a proxy server, or whatever, this thing should still work as we say it should work in the first four. So, you know, it's easy to get sort of academic about these restraints. I think we should look at these here for the purpose of understanding what it is that Fielding's original vision is, and then what parts of this make sense for us to implement. You know, you can get into a real beer argument over whether or not a particular service is RESTful or not. I don't think for us that's the point, right? The point is to understand what the vision is and then implement the pieces of this vision that make sense for you. So the way that we're going to implement that vision is we're going to do it through Web API. Web API is a framework for building these HTTP-based services. These HTTP-based services that you build with Web API could certainly be RESTful. We can make them RESTful using Web API. We might choose to expose some O data with them, or we could create a service that just has custom functionality that maybe isn't RESTful but is operating across HTTP verbs. So that's a key thing, is you really have a lot of latitude as to how you create this Web API service. But what makes it RESTful would be your implementation of the REST constraints, not the fact that you use Web API. Make sense? That's just going to get you a service that works over HTTP. It's part of the ASP.NET MVC family. So if you were here in the previous session, how many folks were here for Bob German's session? Give me a hand. It's great. Good to see that. So Bob was talking to you about the model view controller pattern in ASP.NET MVC. And Web API is really an extension of that. And I emphasize this in a couple of different talks that I did this week, that basically if you stop and you think about what it is that a web page gives you, a web page is giving you essentially an HTML representation of an entity, right? I need some kind of HTML that I'm going to show you in the browser that shows you this entity. But why does it have to be HTML? Why can't it be XML? Why can't it be JSON, right? So what I want you to think about is it doesn't really matter what the form of that is coming back, whether it's XML, JSON, or HTML. We're really talking about the same process. A client performs a get on an endpoint. That endpoint responds with some agreed-upon representation, which you can then use. And so once you understand that, it makes perfect sense that ASP.NET MVC5 should also be the place where you create your RESTful services. And in fact, we're going to see that you can mix page representations with data representations in exactly the same project. It really doesn't care. It uses the same model view controller paradigm. It also means that we're going to be very concerned about controllers and routing. We'll have more to say about that as we go along. One of the great things about ASP.NET MVC is all the tooling, wizards, and scaffolding that you get inside of it. So I've said this several times too, which is that Model View Controller is a great theoretical pattern that provides separation of concerns, ease of testing, and a lot of wonderful things that Bob had addressed in the previous talk. But it would be very difficult for you to, from scratch, implement an MVC service. The reason that it works, the reason that we care about it, is because of the excellent tooling that we get in Visual Studio. That's the reason that you should care about this particular way of creating a RESTful service, is all the tooling, wizard, scaffolding that you get. And as I said, you can create these as a standalone endpoint, or you can make them part of a larger MVC application. Here's a diagram that shows Model View Controller with the web API. Not surprisingly, it looks a lot like the Model View Controller with Angular or the Model View Controller with MVC5 because it's Model View Controller. And as I said, we're not particularly concerned with the form of the data. So in this case, we have controllers, right, that read and write to a data store. Could be a database, could be something else. And then that controller is responsible for building up a model that is a representation of the data in the database. And what we're striving for here is a transformation of the data that's in that data store from some, you know, normalized format to some object-based format. And again, referencing the previous section, Bob showed a little bit about entity framework, which is an object relational map that allows you to alter the data form from relational tables into an object. That's what the controller is going to build up in the model. And then that model is going to be sent off to the client. If I were showing you a diagram of Model View Controller with MVC5, the block that says client would actually be a view, right? Because what we'd want to do is take the HTML and represent it in a view. But now what we're going to do is take the XML or the JSON and do something else with it, perhaps in our JavaScript. So the heart and soul of this whole Model View Controller pattern is really the controllers. So for us now, focusing a little bit on building that RESTful service, the controllers that we create are going to inherit from the API controller class. And what that's going to do for us right away is by default map the HTTP verbs into various methods that get created for us. So this is actually ridiculously simple and just sort of has that simplicity and brilliance, which is when you're performing these HTTP operations, they just go into methods that you define in the controller. So when someone does a post, you get a call to a method. The data they posted shows up there, and you can take some action. If they do a get, you get a request in another method. You can take some action and send them some data back. So I think you'll find this paradigm to be pretty straightforward and easy to get up and running on. The other key piece you need to understand before we can get started in anything significant is the idea of routing. I've talked about this a little bit too in previous sessions, but routing is the concept that says, I would like to divorce the uniform resource indicator that you put in the browser or you utilize in your JavaScript from any actual piece of artifact that's in the project, right? So for example, if I say to you guys, how many folks have written an ASP.NET application? All your hands go up, right? So everybody's written an ASP.NET application. And if you think about ASP.NET applications, what you type in the browser always ends with ASPX. And so you develop this sort of paradigm in your mind that says a uniform resource locator has to point to a page. It's an HTML page, it's an ASPX page, and then you get this idea that what you're asking for is a page. But that's not right. What you're asking for is a representation of an entity. It may come back as HTML, it may come back as something else. So the idea that we're bound to URLs that end with ASPX is really limiting to us. We need to get away from that. I would rather specify an endpoint that says I want contacts /1, and it returns to me the first contact from the data store. And so that's what routing does for us. It allows us to separate those URIs from any kind of physical artifact that we have in our project. So that's a key thing, too. Now, we get a lot of help in Web API in our projects with routes. You see some code here that we'll revisit, but this is basically a route definition here on the slide that is defining a default route that begins with API and then has these substituted in values, which is the name of the controller that you want, and then an optional ID for an item that should be passed in. But what you can see right here on the slide is that what routing does is it's routing a routing maps a uniform resource indicator to a method in a controller. That's the key shift from page-based thinking into model view controller thinking. That one concept right there is probably the most critical for making sense of the whole thing. The MVC framework is smart about making decisions. So what it'll do is it'll examine the URI that you're requesting, and it'll figure out what controllers and methods most make sense and do mapping into that. And what that means to you is you can have optional elements in there, and it's still smart enough to figure out, based on the verb that you've supplied and the form of the URI, exactly which controller. So inside, then, of the service, what we're going to do is create these controllers, and we're going to respond to these HTTP requests that we get. Other things that we get in Web API that make Web API very attractive to us is automatic content negotiation. So if you ask the service for JSON, then it's happy to give you the data in a JSON form. If you ask for it in XML, you'll get it in an XML form, really with no work on your part. So those renderings are created for you and sent out based on what's requested. If you return an iQueryable from the methods, then you're going to be able to support query syntax, the OData query syntax, which we'll touch on in a little bit. But also within the controller, we have full access to the headers that get returned as well. So really, my point here is just on this slide, you can see that we're going to have access to all the data that goes back. We're going to be able to say what kind of data goes back. We're going to be able to provide headers that go back, as well as status codes like OK or bad request. All that stuff we can send back from our controllers. And it's a pretty straightforward thing. I mean, I have big fonts here so you guys can see them in the back. And you can see all the code fits on one slide. OK, so here's an example of just calling a Web API controller from an MVC5 controller. Now, the reason I'm showing you this is that the point here is that you can include, as I said, both MVC5 and Web API controllers in the same project. So this is a controller from MVC5. We see an action result here that's returned from our index. And if you look way down at the bottom, you'll see the view bag and the view. And so this should be recognizable to you as a controller that's designed to return data and then send it to a view for binding. So where's that data coming from? Well, what we're doing is building up a URL here that points to API values, some controller that we created. And then we're using HTTP web request to do a get against that, ask for XML back. And then I'm using an HTTP web response and an X document to parse out the values. And that's where I'm getting my data. So this is moderately interesting in that I can mix the Web API functionality with the MVC functionality and have my MVC controllers call my Web API controllers. I don't find too many scenarios for this type of thing, but it's important to know that you can do that. You could mix them together. Normally, what you do that for, the real reason you would be mixing them together, is because you're creating an MVC5 application and you would like to expose an API for your application. Let that sink in for a minute. So I'm writing this whole enterprise system and I would like to make it extensible by providing a RESTful endpoint. Do you know any enterprise systems that provide RESTful endpoints? I can think of one. He's like, I do. Does it start with S-H-A-R-E? Right? So that's a much more interesting reason to mix Web API controllers with MVC. But you could also make them stand alone and call them from JavaScript. So here we see the basic JavaScript for calling into a Web API controller. And if you've consumed the RESTful services from SharePoint, this you just kind of go, oh, yeah, okay, I get it, right? Because really what's going on here, the only difference is I have a different endpoint I'm going after, API values, And I have a little bit different accept header where I'm asking for application JSON. But still, this is a jQuery AJAX call that returns a success and failure function and returns to me data if I'm successful, returns to me an error if I'm not. So the key thing about this is that when you go to consume these web API services that you make, you will consume them in largely the same way that you consume SharePoint stuff. And so that's a really important thing to think about, because if you buy into my argument that the world is all moving towards client-side over HTTP, and the SharePoint app model is merely a manifestation of that reality, right? So quick editorializing here. I hear an awful lot of discussion in the SharePoint community about, I don't know if I'm bought into the app model. Is it sandbox too? Is it going to be here in the next version? I don't know. That's entirely the wrong discussion. Because what the app model is right now, with its strengths and weaknesses, is nothing more than a manifestation of the long-term reality that we are moving to client-side over HTTP. That's not going to change. It's not going to change. That's where we're going. So the app model today represents a version of that. But having a discussion about its plumbing and whether or not you buy into it misses the larger trend. That's a real thing, a real point I want you guys to take with you. So now if you buy that, right, if you buy what I just said, then you have to get to the place where you go, well, I don't have any choice now but to wrap my own databases in RESTful services so that I can play in that same paradigm. Why would I want to talk to SharePoint with REST? Why would I want to talk to Office 365 with REST and then try to do some kind of thing where I'm talking using server-side code and, you know, entity framework or something to a database on the back end? Makes more sense to do it as REST. Okay, so with all of that as our foundation, let's go ahead and take a look at a demo here so we can get started. So the first thing that I want to do for you is we're just going to go ahead and create a service here. And my goal in creating this service is basically to show you how ridiculously simple this is. So I'm going to come in here and create a new project, and we're going to go to web. And when I click on web, you're going to see that I'm creating an ASP.NET web application here. Now, all of the MVC stuff and the ASP.NET stuff and the web API stuff is now lumped under this one thing, ASP.NET web application. And we go ahead and click OK. Let me make sure it's in a spot I can delete it later. Yep, looks good. Let's go ahead and click OK. And now what it does is it brings up a second dialog for me where you can see all the different things that you can create. So I can create an empty one there. I can create a web forms, which is your traditional ASP.NET application. I can create MVC, which is that MVC 5 stuff that Bob was working on. Here's our web API project right there. We also have a single page application, important concept we've discussed a couple of times. And then if you'd like to be a billionaire, you can create Facebook right there. It's pretty good, right? All right, along with this, you also have support for various authentications. So I can click on change authentication. You can see we have no authentication, which is what I'll be using for the most part in the beginning. We have individual authentication, where we can do things like SQL Server databases, organizational accounts, where we can do things like Office 365, and then good old Windows authentication. So my point here to you is that I recognize that many of you are in various states, right? So a lot of people have may have Office 365. A lot of people may still have most of this stuff on premises. And so being able to support various authentication mechanisms is important if you're going to adopt this thing. You want to know that it works in the environment that you have. Okay, so we're just going to do no authentication for now. Click OK, and we're going to come back and, again, talk about authentication a little bit more in the later parts of the talk. And so this thing's going to chug along here, and like most of the stuff in Visual Studio these days, it makes for me a project right away. Now, what I want to do is take a minute to look at the pieces that are here so I can really solidify in your mind the basics that you need to understand this. Because if you haven't done anything with MVC before or Web API, you make one of these projects, and if I hit F5, it'll run. But then what you do is you look in the Solution Explorer and you go, wow, that's a lot of stuff in there, right? And it takes a little while to absorb what all this stuff is. So let's pick on what I think are the most important parts. Remember, this is model view controller stuff. So really, the heart of it is here inside of the controllers folder, where we can create these controllers. And you'll see that I have two controllers in this project here. One is called the home controller, the other is the values controller. So what they do when you make this dummy project, which is a web API project, is they actually give you one controller that's MVC5 and one controller that's web API. The values controller is your web API controller. But you'll also notice that there's this home page here. It says your ASP.NET application. You can see it. So when you fire this up, you're actually going to get a page, but that's just because it defaults to the HTML controller, right? But we do have our web API controller in there. We'll take a look at that in just a second. The next key thing to understand before you go any further is routing. So routing, as I said, maps the URIs into some controller. There's a couple of different places to define routes. For web API, we care about this class called web API config. That's convenient. That looks right, right? Web API config. And inside of web API config, you can define your routes. Our project has a default route defined, as you saw on the slide, which basically takes API, then the name of the controller, and an optional ID to follow. For the most part, this is going to work. We're not going to have to really tweak this. A couple of key things here. MVC differentiates routes that are intended to show pages from routes that are intended to act as APIs by putting this API in front of it. That's just so you can have endpoints by the same name but differentiated by API. Do you know any other product that puts an API in front of things, right? So it follows the same idea that SharePoint does with underscore API. And that will just be what we have to type in to our URI. Okay, so once you get routing and you get controllers, then you can come back here and take a look. Now, we'll go ahead and take a look at this values controller, which is the default web API controller. Notice that it inherits from API controller, like I said it would. And then the name is values controller. So the way that the framework works is that the name you'll use in your URI is actually the part that comes before the word controller, so values. And you're expected to name your controllers something, something, controller. And then the route will pick up the quote name by just typing in values, right? And then the other thing that I said was cool about this is that you get this automatic mapping of HTTP verbs into methods. So you can see that we have a get. You can see that we have a get that allows us to provide that optional ID. You can see that we have post, put, and delete. So there you are. Those are the places that we would write our code. Ridiculously simple, right? So now I can go ahead and fire this thing up. And I'm running Fiddler here in the background so that we can take a look at the communication between client and server. It's chugging along there. Okay, now it comes up. So as I said, by default, we're routed to that visual page here. So don't let this throw you off. We don't really care too much about this. What we're going to do now is come up here, and in the browser, we're going to go ahead and put in a URI that points to our web API service. So we'll type in API, the prefix, and then our controller was called values, right? So there's my API values, all I got to put in. And then I'm going to go ahead and hit enter, and it'll go off to that, and you can see that what it does is it returns JSON to me. If we go into Fiddler here, let's remove this for a second, and we refresh this. Do that again. You can come into Fiddler, and you'll see there's the call going into API values. And then if you haven't done this a lot with Fiddler, it's super useful for what we're doing here to be able to see the communication back and forth. I can come up to the top, which is the goes into, and I can click on the raw here. And then on the bottom, I can see the goes outta, and we'll click on JSON, and there we have value one and value two coming back. Okay, so this allows us to work with those web services without having to create a separate client and make sure that thing is working correctly. Well, this is pretty cool because it's ridiculously simple to get started, but we'd like to look at something that's a little bit more significant. So I'm going to go ahead and close this project out, and then we're going to, you know, we're going to do that cooking show thing where I just pull the entire turkey out now. I'll show you how that works. Okay, so here I have a solution that has now a service in it called Fundamental Web API. So there's my project, Fundamental Web API. I also have in here a SharePoint app called Values Client. We'll be taking a look at that a little bit later. But we've got a controller in here, and the controller is the values controller. You'll notice that what I've done, just for simplicity, is I've removed all of the visual parts. So all the MVC5 stuff I've taken out of this project, and we're left only with the values controller. If we go into the values controller, we can do fun stuff with the code, like make sure we put breakpoints in all of the mappings. And you can see now that I've fleshed out the posts, the puts, and deletes. And we're starting with just a basic set of data where you can see that I have just some simple things in here. I have the word, you know, the term SharePoint hosted and the term provider hosted as our starting data. So now if I go ahead and fire this thing up, still, when I F5 it from Visual Studio, it's going to want to start Internet Explorer, but it doesn't have any visual thing to represent anymore because I ripped all that out. So it just tells us that that's forbidden, which we don't care about. It's fine. It's running right now. And now what we can do is we'll go up here and we'll clear out Fiddler so we can see what we're doing. And then I'll type in API values like that. And you can see that, sure enough, it jumped into the get where it's going to return everything for me. I hit F5 to keep on going. And then here's the values that came back now. So now I have a JSON representation that's a little bit more significant than what I had before. Now, what's cool about Fiddler is I can come back in here to Fiddler now, find that call that was made. There it is, right? It recorded that call. And now what I can do is go to what's called the Composer tab. And the Composer tab allows you to create HTTP requests that get played against that server. So I'm going to grab this guy and drag him over here and drop it. And then what I could do is click this execute button, and it would automatically replay what we just did and bring it back to us. So that's nice, but what we want to do is fix this up a little bit. So the first thing I want to do is point this out to you, the accept header. So what the accept header does is the accept header says what you want back from the service, right? And when you have */*, it basically says, I'll take anything you have to offer. But what we're going to do is be a little bit more specific, and we're going to come in here and say that we would like our return value to be application/XML. All right, so now we're asking for XML back. I'm going to go ahead and execute this now. You can see it jumps into the get method. That's great. Go ahead and hit F5. It comes back. And now if I click on this one, which is the one we just did that's recorded, now go back to the inspector tab and come down here and look at the XML, you can see now I'm receiving XML. It's a little bit more clear when you go to the raw view, so you can actually see the XML down there at the bottom that was generated. And the point of showing you this is that you can see that my service engaged in automatic content negotiation. So if I ask for JSON, I get JSON. If I ask for XML, I get XML. I didn't have to do anything to generate that form of the entity. I just got it back that way. So that's pretty cool. If I come back up here to the Composer now, I could change this back to application JSON. And if I click execute, it's going to do the same thing, but bring back to me a JSON representation. Okay, but let's do a little bit more then. So now what I'm going to do is let's try to actually put something into the data. So I'm going to come up here and change my get to a post like this. And now when I do a post, I'm going to be sending data up. So in order to make this happen, not only do I have to say the form of the data I want back, but I have to say the form of the data I am giving you, right? Because I could give you XML, I could give you JSON, and we have to agree on what we're going to do. So I'm going to do that using the content type header, and I'm simply going to say, I will provide to you application JSON information, and then I expect you to give me application JSON back. And then I'm going to come in here to the body, and I'm just going to type what I want to add, and we'll just say, here's a new item, like that. Okay? So now, hopefully what you recognize in what we're doing here is you recognize some of the programming that you've been doing against SharePoint. When you consume data from SharePoint, you have to ask for these same things. But I think one of my goals in presenting this is that I want you guys to really become experts on what's happening under the covers in HTTP, because that becomes a critical skill for us now, right? Not just putting in content type because, you know, it's in chapter 3 of the app book, but putting in there because you know exactly why it's supposed to be there. Now we click execute, and you can see that I've jumped into the post. You see that? So I didn't do anything special. Web API maps that post verb into this post method. And then if I hover over the text right here, can you see it in the back? Can I do it? Yeah, it's kind of shadowed there. But you can see the value of the text is actually new items. So what I put in the body has now been passed into the method. How easy is that? I can do whatever I want with it there. Press F5, and we go back. And now what's happened is I've gotten a return value. So let's come in here and look at the inspectors, and we'll put both of these in raw. And then you can see that here with the post, you can see the information that's gone in. There's the new item being posted, and then the response that we're getting back. Now, what I want to point out to you is not only you can see the new item in the body, that's great, you probably expected that, but what my code is doing is it's also returning something called location. This is really important because you see that link right there that says API values 3? What's being returned to me is the URI for the new thing that got added. That's part of the REST specification. That's what we're supposed to be doing. We're supposed to be providing that linking information back from the server. So in this case, what is the location of the new thing that got created? And if we come into our service now, you'll see that inside the post, I am setting the location header, response.headers.location, and I am setting that to the new URI that would be used to access it. So I point this out to you only because I want you to get used to this idea of those RESTful constraints, understand what it is that they mean and what you're responsible for providing back to the client and what they expect to get from you. So that's a good example of implementing, what do we have, content negotiation and then linking. Okay. Let's go ahead and come back to the composer now. Now what I want to do is do a put inside of here. And what we can do is go to values 3 now, which is the one that we just added, right? And we'll do a put, so we want to update this thing. And let's do new item updated like that. Okay, so now this put operation is going to go specifically against that new endpoint. We'll go ahead and click execute, and now you can see it jumps into the put, and it sends in the new text, which says new item updated, and then if I hit F5, it keeps running. I go back now, look at the return value that we got in the inspectors, and then we'll see a couple of interesting things that are going on in here. First of all, notice I have expiration information right here, so remember, we were talking about indicating whether or not things could be cached. And then we can see the new item updated going in there inside the put. Let's see here. Looking at the headers. Something I wanted to show you on this. I don't see it. Thought I was generating e-tags for this, but that's okay. Let's just talk about it for a minute. The other thing that you want to do with your service is you want to be able to send back what are called e-tags. E-tags basically track the version of each item that you're sending up there. SharePoint does the same thing. And what you're expected to do is to pass that e-tag up whenever you edit an item, and it can be used to implement optimistic concurrency. So if you go and you get an item, and that has an e-tag of 1, and later you do a put against that item, and on the server, the e-tag is now 3, what does that mean? It means that 2 changes have happened since you pulled the item in the first case, and then you have to decide how your service is going to respond to that, right? So there has to be some kind of optimistic concurrency that you implement. Okay, great. So that's a good look at the basic operations, and I think the thing I want you to take away from that is really just how easy it is to implement this controller where you have the HTTP methods mapped into the methods of your controller, and then you can take action. In our case, we're just using a very simple list of values, but truly, we could have any data source we want back there. Okay, let's jump back to the slides then. checking where we are. Okay, next, we'll talk about building OData services. So building the OData services is really just layered on top of the RESTful stuff that we've been doing. The thing about OData is OData is a type of RESTful service, and it's a standardized REST API specifically for CRUD operations. We care very much about OData. SharePoint provides its RESTful information to us as OData, so SharePoint exposes OData endpoints to us. And what's important about OData is it has standardized data types. So for example, on the slide here, you can see GUID, string, Boolean, and int32 associated with ID, title, tree view enabled, and UI version. I pulled this part of the slide from the $ metadata endpoint in SharePoint, which returns to you the entity schema that the RESTful service generates. And in fact, we have the $ metadata endpoint available to us in the services that we create as well. But the point is that we have standardized types. SharePoint utilizes these standardized types. We're going to utilize these standardized types. And the point that I want to make to you about this is that this is really where you want to focus your attention on creating these OData services, because OData is primarily about create, read, update, and delete. And if you think about writing your own services, you're probably most likely going to be introducing databases that you have into this equation exposed as services. You're going to want to expose them as OData services. And then we have this standardized URI format that says when we ask for entities, we're going to use a certain format and support certain query options that occur afterwards. As I said, the service document is available at $ metadata. It's available from SharePoint there. Actually, if you have a SharePoint online site, Office 365 site, you can just type the $ metadata in the browser, and you'll see SharePoint bring up the entire schema for the RESTful endpoints. We talked about the types, the data types, but we also have these standard entity types, or the definitions of the entity types, and you can see right from the $ metadata definitions for site, web, list, and list item. And really what's happening here in OData is you're basically getting back things like an SP site, SP web, SP list in an XML or JSON representation. So the right way to think about what you're doing with REST is really just exercising the API in a different way. And that's what OData brings to us, this standardization that allows us to interact with these entities more simply. OData also provides a standard set of query options, like the ability to select what fields you want, filter, order by, select a certain number, skip a certain number, and expand relationships. SharePoint supports these query options. When you make an OData service with Web API, it will also support these query options. So again, my point to you is that you're doing things in a standard way so that people know what to expect from your service and how to properly utilize it. Much like what we just did with the basic Web API stuff, what we're going to do with our OData services is we're going to have controllers and routes, but in this case, we're going to inherit from OData controller. That's the big difference right there. We're still going to have controllers and routes and follow all the basic stuff that we did, but now we're going to inherit from OData controller. The methods are still mapped to HTTP verbs, just like they were when we utilized API controller. The content negotiation is automatic, just like it was before. But then our return values, you're going to see in the code, come back as iQueryable. The reason you care about that is that when it comes back as iQueryable, then you're going to be able to support those standard OData queries that I was just showing you, like $ select. So you're getting that stuff for free. So you can see how much of this work is done for you, making it very easy to create these services. Just like with our API controllers that we saw, we have routes. The routes are controlled a little bit differently. You have this object called the OData Convention Builder model. But in the end, you're still creating routes in much the same way as we were with API. The syntax just looks a little different. Instead of using API as your prefix, it's traditional to use OData as your prefix. So now you're going /OData/customers. The router still makes good decisions for us if information is missing. And by default, as we said, we map to these HTTP verbs. So the takeaway here is that an OData service is really just a version of what we had done before. So let's take a look then at how that might work. When I push the right button. There we go. All right. So really, if you're doing OData, the scenario you're most likely in is you're trying to expose a database. And so it becomes really simple to be able to expose a database, because what you can do is come into the project and you can add to the project a new ADO.NET entity data model. And so we can give this a name. We can just keep it as model one. I'm not going to walk through this whole thing. But what happens is we'll create a wizard. We'll have a wizard come up that will allow us to create a new entity data model based on a database. Now, in the previous session, Bob showed you what we call code first in entity framework, which means he made a class, and then he had that class used as something to generate a database. So the code was written first, and then Entity Framework generated the database to map to the code that was written. This wizard here is a database-first approach, which means go look at a database that I have and generate me some classes that work with that. That's the most likely scenario I think you'll be in, because probably that database exists already. We're trying to wrap it and make it available to our SharePoint apps. Once you get that done, then you can come into a controller, to the controllers folder, and say you'd like to add a new controller. And then in the scaffolding, what you can say is I'd like to add a new web API to OData controller with actions. And what this thing will do now is then create the controller for you that has all of the mapped HTTP verbs and uses link to perform CRUD operations against the database. So once again, it's incredibly simple to do it. It does a lot of the heavy lifting for you. In the interest of time, we're going to go pull the full thing out again here. So I'll go to an OData service that I have. And if we look in this OData service that I have, you'll see that I have a couple of controllers here. To make it simple, we can go ahead and a little bit more clarity. Let's see if we can bring up SQL Server here. And so I imagine that what you will be doing is you'll say, we have this very important database at our place where we'd like to expose that to SharePoint apps. And we'll imagine this is my little people database here that maybe has some HR information or what have you. And you can see that my little people database has companies and contact tables in it. When I walk through the process of creating the entity framework model using the database first approach, then it's going to build for me entities that represent apparently contacts and companies. Was that what's in the database? I don't know. Was it contacts and companies? It may be the different database. Okay, I think that was it, right? Anyway, so you can see my entities here are contacts and company information. And so that's the representation of the data that's in the database right there. Now, if we go up to the controllers and we right-click this thing and we say we want to add the new controller, then when I go into the controller, notice I'm going to get a companies and contacts controller, which will allow me to do reads and writes against those entities. So for the most part, that stuff got created for me. We can go in and look at the contacts thing here. This is the one we really want to focus on anyway. Scroll this thing down, and you can see that it inherits from OData controller, right? And then I have all these different methods that map to the HTTP verbs. And they're named a little bit different, but you can see, like get contacts and get contact, this maps to a get. This maps to a get with a specific ID. Then you can see the put, right, the post, and the deletes. And then buried inside of this is link code that's now reading and writing to the database. So I'm really doing much the same thing as I was doing in the first demo, but now I've just got a database backing it instead of just a collection. Well, let's go ahead and fire this up, see how it works. When I started in Visual Studio, of course, it's going to start up again a browser, but we don't have any visual things, so it shows me that forbidden, but that's okay, because we can just go ahead and start with this endpoint, and then we're going to clear out. Ooh, wow, let's try that again. There you go. Okay, remove everything from it. All right, and then we can come back here and get started now. Let's do this one first. I'm going to come in here and I'm going to type OData, right? So the mapping, as I showed you in the slide, the mapping that gets done by default assumes this OData prefix for everything. And then what I'm going to do for starters is let's just go ahead and say $OData $metadata. So I didn't do anything special here. I'm going to get this metadata endpoint pretty much for free. And if I run this metadata endpoint, you can see that what I get back is all the entity schema information for the database as it is represented in OData. So now if you were sitting in my talk yesterday when we did Breeze, you saw me actually use Breeze. It went in and it read this schema and then generated entities for us and we could read and write to it. So again, my point is how simple this is to do. You now have an OData compliant service that serves up an entire metadata map that can be consumed by things like Breeze to easily make CRUD apps in SharePoint. Okay, so that's pretty cool. But now let's go ahead and look at some actual data. So now what I'm going to do is come in here and we'll say OData contacts. And let me go ahead and just copy this out so we can sort of keep track of the things that we did. So that's the one I'm going to do now. We'll go ahead and say OData contacts. We'll click enter on that and it chugs for a second. I can see it working. Okay, and then it returns to me this representation. And you can see here comes all the JSON information from the database right there. If I go back to Fiddler, we can pick on the session where it was traced, and we'll go to the JSON format. I just clicked on it. Ooh, that doesn't look good. Yeah, that never feels good when you're doing a demo. Okay, and now look, you can see that I've got back this JSON representation of the data, right? But let's pause for a moment and really think about what just happened here. I'm now getting back a JSON representation over HTTP of data that's in a SQL database. And I did that for you in a relatively short period of time. I could now turn around and use jQuery in my SharePoint apps to read and write against this, and I'm following exactly the same paradigm that I follow when I go against SharePoint lists. And once you realize how easy this is to do and how it all fits so neatly together, you can't help but acknowledge that you're going to have to be creating some of these services. All right, so that's cool. But also, if we come in here to, let me do it in the Composer. Let's go into the Composer and we'll just grab what we had done. There's our OData contacts. But for free, I also get support for all of those OData standards. Like I can come in here and say, ?top equals 50. And then I'll execute that again. And when I do that, you can see the session down here that just ran. We'll go to the inspector. And now what I've got is just the top 50 here. You'll have to believe me. I didn't bring back everything. But that's the top 50. Okay? Come back to the Composer and say, okay, that was the top 50. That was great. And now I can come in here and say ampersand. I'd also like to select just the last name like that. And now let's go ahead and execute that again. And here's our session that just ran. We'll come back to the inspector. And now you can see that I'm clearly just returning last names. Okay? You like that? Okay, but we can do even better. All right, so let's go ahead and do $$ and order those by last name. Okay, we run that again. Come down here, look at the inspector, and you can see now clearly they've been reordered. We can see the A's at the top. So my point in showing you all this really is that I'm getting all this standardized behavior now, and this is what people expect when they're going to consume your source. They expect you to be able to respond to these standard OData things. And this is really, if I haven't emphasized it enough, this is really why you care about OData. Because if you're going to expose your services and they're exposed as OData, then I understand what you did, I understand how to ask for things, and it makes it much easier to write those SharePoint apps that can give you mashups of various data stores. Okay, so that's it for OData. Let's jump back to the slides and keep pressing on here. So now, that's really cool. I was able to very quickly make these API services. I was very quickly able to take a database and expose it as an OData source. And I'm hoping in your mind at this point you can see how you would write some jQuery to read and write that, and you have that vision now of how it works. But when I take these databases and I expose them, what we've done so far is we've exposed them all anonymously, right? So there are certainly some things that we need to be concerned about. We can't expose our databases as anonymous endpoints. So things that you have to think about when you do this. Some of you have come to me after the sessions that we've done this week and said, I'm very concerned about JavaScript. I was told it's not secure and I should not do anything with it, right? And there, in this model, in this web cloud-based model, you have to be smarter about security than you ever have before. All of you folks, a whole bunch of you folks, raise your hand and said, I did ASP.NET stuff. If you want some fun, do a little bit of research on all the things that ASP.NET does for you to implement secure communication that you don't even know it's doing. It does tons of stuff for you. But the problem is we're sort of tearing all that away now, and we're taking two steps back, writing our own JavaScript and our own services. And if we don't step up now and become responsible for all the various attacks that could happen to us and be careful with how we implement things, we could end up in trouble. So it means that we have to be concerned now about tokens and anti-forgery and cross-site scripting, and all those things have to be foremost in our mind. And in fact, I was telling somebody on Yammer that I thought that would be a great session to go over every single way that you could, you know, attack this model and how you're supposed to solve that. All right, so we'll also have that for a future date. So some things to think about, though, in general. When you're talking about SharePoint apps, I do not care if they're on-premise or in the cloud, you must use HTTPS. You must. You do not want to be in the business of sending this stuff back and forth in plain text, right? If you take your HR database, even if it's intended to be used internally, and you hit it with HTTP, you are sending personal information clear back and forth between the SharePoint app. You can't be in that business. It has to be secure sockets layer. That is the most fundamental security decision you have to make, is to use SSL. You need to think about your authorization, your authentication and authorization. We talked a little bit about how we have support for Windows, FBA, Basic, Token, OAuth. I'm going to show you here as the wrap-up for this session how to do token authentication. You also have to be concerned about what's called the same origin policy. So all browsers have this idea of the same origin policy, which says, as a browser, I will not access a resource or run a script that does not come from the same origin as the initial app. That's why SharePoint apps all run in their own origin, is to ensure that same origin policy is applied to each app. But wait a second. I'm advocating that you take data sources in your organization, expose them as RESTful endpoints, and then allow multiple SharePoint apps to talk to them and perform mashups. Well, that's going to violate same origin policy. So we need a safe workaround for that. There are some workarounds for that that have been floating around, like perhaps you've done JSONP. But the one that you really want to get involved with that's implemented in Web API is called cross-origin resource sharing. Cross-origin resource sharing. Cross-origin resource sharing is a way to allow JavaScript to make cross-domain calls safely. It's superior to the idea of JSONP because JSONP only supports GET, And for those of you that are unfamiliar with JSONP, basically what it does is it injects a JavaScript object into your page. So it doesn't look like you're running cross-origin code. It just looks like some data magically appeared in your page. So it's kind of a hack, but it does work. But cross-origin resource sharing is superior to that. And basically, the way cross-origin resource sharing works is that the client and the server exchange headers, and the client says, I want to call you from this origin, and the server looks at its whitelist and says whether or not that's allowed, and then responds to the client and saying, yes, you can call me, and if that response is positive, then the browser will call to the service, allowing you to have a model where you have an endpoint that can be called by multiple SharePoint applications from different domains. If you want to enable it in Web API 2, it's relatively straightforward. You're going to install the Microsoft ASP.NET Web API 2 Cores NuGet package. So you're going to right-click your solution, and you're going to type C-O-R-S in the search for NuGet and install that package. And then what you have to do is go to the Web API config class, enable cores, and then use the enable cores attribute on the controller where you want to enable that. Here's a slide that shows a communication between the client and server. Just snapshot it right out of Fiddler. So you can see that what's happening in this is what we call a pre-flight request. So what cores will do, if things are very simple, is the client will just send a header up and say, can I call you? If things are complex, like I would like to write new data in, I need to check and see whether you actually are going to let me write data, because it may be okay for me to read cross-domain, but maybe I can't write cross-domain. So I need to check first. So we're engaging in what's called a pre-flight request. And at the top, you can see the access control request header, where we're saying, these are the headers that I have. This is what I want to do. I want to do a put, and this is the origin I'm coming from. See that? And then the response from the Web API service says, I allow origin star, which means I allow everybody, which is probably not what we want to do. But it says, it's okay, because I allow everybody, and I allow put, and I allow the headers you ask for. And when this little exchange takes place between the server and the client, now the call will go through, and the operation will succeed. That's how cross-origin resource sharing works. You need to be very concerned about security with this, so don't be in the business of allowing all domains to call your service, because what can happen here, although it's a sort of a narrow window, what can happen here is you could easily download a page with some malicious script off the internet, and then because you have cross-origin resource sharing set up to allow any domain to talk to your server, that page could conceivably talk to services even though they're inside the firewall. Now, granted, you'd have to know a little bit of something about the infrastructure, but perhaps you're a disgruntled employee and you do. Or perhaps you've used some social engineering to determine these things, and now you're going to have somebody download it and do that. So you always want to whitelist the domains that can call it. That's the real security thing. Don't be this clown that allows everybody through. Okay, so let's take a look then at some cross-origin resource sharing. This is relatively straightforward process to do. I'm going to go back to the solution that we were using before. So we'll stop debugging. Okay, we'll open up this one. This is the first solution that I showed you. But what just happened? Thank you. Nice of you guys to do that for me. Okay, still have to press the right button. There you go. All right, better. Okay, this is the first one we did before. So what we're going to do is take this one I did in demo number one and make it support cross-origin resource sharing. So what you would do is right-click and say Manage NuGet Packages, and you would go searching for that cores package and install it. Then you have to come to the Web API config, where we defined our routes, remember our route definition? And you add this line of code that says enable cores. That simple. Then you go to the controller, and you will add to the controller an attribute that says what it is that you want to support. So here you can see that I'm allowing all domains, all methods, all headers. That's what the stars are. And obviously that's not what you want to do. So we could, we have some other samples up here that show you that I could have a specific domain if I wanted. So here's a specific app domain if I wanted. And then you could conceivably keep these app domains in, say, a database or something, or even the webdoc config, and check a whitelist of all the apps that you want to allow to talk to this. And in fact, you can go back to this place where you enable cores, and you could set up universal whitelisting rules here, because you can put more stuff in this parentheses right here, and then allow it to happen. So within this then, let's go ahead and start this up. So within this then, I have this values app. And this is just a SharePoint app that's calling. So we're going to come run this. Okay. And let's see, this is on the web services site. Just trying to make sure I get the right one here. Values, right? Okay, so let's... There it is, values client app. And I go ahead and click on this thing, and it's going to be kind of anticlimactic. Oh, that was not anticlimactic, was it? Let's try Internet Explorer. Because in theory, it should just work. That's the idea behind it. It's just going to work. Let's click on it there. Oh. 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 So much fun. It is secure. There is no doubt about it. Sometimes what happens is Fiddler gets busy on in the way with acting as a proxy. All right. Last thing we're going to do to make this guy work is right-click this thing, say debug, start new instance, keep our fingers crossed. Come on. The point here that I'll talk through is that it should just start up and work. Oh, it's just killing me. I don't know what that is. If you do three talks, one demo has to go awry. All right, so the point here is that this really should just call through, and then it's actually in a separate domain, right? So the whole point of the demo is just to show you the values, and then you'll understand that the SharePoint app is in a different domain. So how did it manage to reach over and get those values, even though they were in a different domain? It did it because of cross-origin resource sharing. So again, setup on it is pretty simple. Let's jump back to the slides here and finish up talking about security here. So again, we talked a little bit about the things that you have to worry about with security. You need to spend some time thinking about how you're going to secure things. Whether they're in the cloud or on premises makes a difference, because you could be using, say, server-to-server high trust. You could be using token-based security. You could be using OAuth. Ted Pattison is giving a great talk on security a little bit later in the week, so I think it might be today or tomorrow. So check that out for more of a discussion. But what I want to talk to you about is a simple way to secure it. So my point to you is you could go into your web API and you could secure your web API using something as simple as Windows authentication. But if you want to do a little bit more, if you need something that maybe is in a hybrid situation or perhaps you're in the cloud, then one simple way to do it is using what are called simple web tokens. Simple web tokens. A simple web token is just an HTML form encoded name value pair that contains some standard things like you'll see audience, expires on, and issuer. And then the key to making this thing work is that it contains this hash inside the token that gets attached to the call that's made back to the service. This stuff can seem really confusing at first when you get started, so it's simpler just to take a look at a little graphical example of how this works. We can see the rectangle, which is the client, the Web API service, which is generically called the relying party, and then I have this MVC5 app, which is a token issuing service. So what happens here is the client is going to attempt to access a secure Web API service, but currently the service doesn't really even know who the client is. So what the service will do is redirect the caller. I don't know who you are. You have no token attached to your call. So I'm going to redirect you over to a separate MVC5 app, which is a token issuing service that will then allow you to log in, authenticate yourself. In this case, we're going to be using forms-based authentication, and will provide an access token back to you. Once the client has the access token, it can turn around and talk to the Web API service by passing in the access token with the call. Now, does that look like anything you're familiar with? That's pretty much exactly the way that SharePoint handles tokens. So my point to you is that this is a good model to follow because we can implement a token service in a way that's very similar to what SharePoint does. So let's take a look at this. I've got my simple web token service here. And you'll notice in here that, yep, again, thank you guys. I'm going to have to pay you if you keep doing that. And I've got my project here with my simple web token OData. So I have an OData service in here. It has a controller with the companies and contacts, but now I also have added this tokens controller right here. And this token controller is going to allow you to call it with basic authentication using username and password. And then what it's going to do is through the utilization of an app ID and an app secret, it is going to generate a simple web token for you and send that back to you. And then what happens is when that's returned to you, right, so you give me username and password, I give you token, then what we can do is write a SharePoint-hosted app, and that SharePoint-hosted app would then be able to bind that token to calls that it makes. So here we can see the JavaScript that first passes in username and password to receive the token, and then what it'll do is bind that token on to a call back to Web API. Here's the authorization header with the access token, and then Web API can authenticate the call from the service using the token, which means two things. It means that the client doesn't have to log in again, and it also means that the app can have its own identity, similar to what we're doing in SharePoint. All right, so let's go ahead and see if we can get this guy to run. This one's not going to act up on us, right? Not going to act up. It's going to be good. All right, simple web token app. Eyes clenched. Click on this guy right here. Oh man. What is the hang up on this last one? Yeah, I know. I could turn on Fiddler and see if that's going to make the difference. Sometimes it gets hang up on that. I didn't see it putting in its thing, though. Let's try to start a new instance from here. There it is, right there. Boom. Stop that. One more time. Oh, I really like this to work. I think Fiddler's got me here, but let's just give it one more shot, see if we can clear it out. That's good, I like that. Start this debugging again. Come back to here, go to web services, and find our app. Ah, that's really disappointing. Really disappointing. All right, so let's just focus on the code there. I think Fiddler got in the way between me and my communication. But here's the thing that you need to take away from this. The JavaScript, the first AJAX call here, calls to the token controller. I showed you the code where the token controller is now going to return an access token to you. That access token can then be taken, and it can be attached to subsequent calls using the authorization header, bearer plus the access token. And then if we go back and look at the actual controller in here, you'll see within the controller itself, we have a simple web token authorization attribute, which validates the token that comes in and then says whether or not you're allowed to call. So the takeaway from the security stuff here is that you can do things if you're on-premise that are as simple as using something like Windows authentication. But if you're in the cloud, if you're providing this service through Azure, like you'd like to maybe create an endpoint in Azure that exposes OData, then you could potentially need something more sophisticated, like a simple web token scenario that would allow you to provide tokens and clients can use those to call back in. This is the same exact way that things like Google work to provide tokens, or that Amazon services provide tokens to you, the same exact strategy that they're using. So that's why you should care about it. Okay, so we're really just at the end of the time here. Let's wrap up on what we did. So we spent our time building some RESTful services. Hopefully you guys recognize what the restraints are for RESTful services. We then turned that into OData services, and we were successful taking databases and exposing them as OData services. We spent some time talking about securing web API services. Fiddler got in my way and stopped my wonderful demo at the end, but hopefully the walkthrough on the code helps you understand what it is that you're trying to do. And that's it. So now you guys should have everything you need to put all the pieces together when you're building your SharePoint apps. This is my last talk, so if you guys have any questions for me, feel free to come up and post those with me. Other than that, I really appreciate you guys this week. I've had a great time with you. Thanks a lot for attending. Enjoy the rest of the time.